Meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Welcome back. I mean, it's a pretty depressing start, isn't it? You know, because there's someone here who is still going to be full of the enthusiasm of the first days in the new job. It's a bit gutting to begin like that. Someone else is probably the sort of hardened office cynic. And it's a little bit tough to be outdone at your own game when you come to church, isn't it? But here we are. You can work as hard as you like. You can play as hard as you like. It's all a waste of time, says our teacher here. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now, it's not really a surprise that people think like that. Plenty of people have always thought that kind of way. The surprise really is, what's that kind of a line doing in the Bible? It's not really where you expect to find it. And you only hope it's because the teacher is facing up to the real questions of life. I mean, if you know anything about this teacher, you'll know that meaningless is something of a catchphrase for him. But you hope he'll have something more to say before the end. And the big questions do have to be faced. Come with me and face the questions with our teacher. You see, he begins with life summarized. I mean, look at verse 3. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Can't you almost see in that verse the infuriating teenager's shrug of the shoulders? You know, whatever. I mean, that's the kind of feel. Life is summarized with a shrug for him. That phrase, under the sun, by the way, which is another common phrase, it comes more than 35 times through the book, and four times in this chapter, if you include its close cousin, under heaven. It really means, if you keep your feet firmly on the ground, if you limit yourself to here and now, to time and space as we see it, no special pleading about some invisible power from above, then all you can do is shrug. Waste of time. I mean, nothing really changes, verse 4. Generations come, generations go. The earth remains forever. Or look at verse 5. You know, the sun rises, the sun sets, and hurries back to where it rises. I mean, there'll be another day. They come around every 24 hours. And it goes on, the wind blows to the south and blows to the north. And round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. I mean, in the end, one weather forecast looks much like another, doesn't it? That's how it goes. And all streams flow into the sea, yet the sea's never full. Have you ever worked that one out? Yeah, well, to the place the streams came from, there they return again. He's done his geography GCSE. He understands about evaporation and condensation and precipitation or whatever other big words they are. What goes around comes around. You can be a David Attenborough, you can film as many Planet Earth series as you like, you can marvel, you can wonder, you can gasp, but however much you study this world of nature, you're not going to find a meaning to life. At least not one that satisfies. See, you come to verse 8. And he says, all things are wearisome, more than we can say. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. Move from the world of nature to the world of techies. You know the kind of person, the ear its fill of hearing. You know, people never get satisfied. You know the sort of person who always has to have the latest sound system. They can tell you about every gizmo and why this one makes it even better than the one before. It's lost on an ear like mine, but to them it makes all the difference. And if they've just splurged on it this summer, what's going to happen? By Christmas time, there'll be something that'll make it even better. Life keeps doing that to you. I'm never satisfied. Verse 9, what's been will be again. What's been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. It's Groundhog Day, same old, same old, same old. Yeah, different day, same routine. It's a feeling that catches up on any individual. It's a principle that's painted on broader canvases too. Steve Turner's little poem's very true. History repeats itself. It has to. No one's listening. Well, here is our writer. Pushing us all the time around here. He's not blind to inventions, but he knows there's nothing new under the sun. You know, corruption, violence, these things, they keep reoccurring. Good people who slave away and then everything seems to go wrong. Bad people who get away with it. And people quickly get forgotten. There is no remembrance of men of old, verse 11. And even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who will follow. People quickly get forgotten, don't they? Someone was talking to me to John Stott's funeral about guarding his legacy and everything else. And they talked to me for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then they said, actually, it probably doesn't matter because people forget so quickly these days. They'll very quickly forget him. I mean, it's true. 20 years' time, who's going to remember you at All Souls? I don't mean it rudely. 100 years' time, who's going to remember any of us? By the year 2200, no one's going to remember our children. That's life. Well, it's all a very contemporary way of thinking in one sense, isn't it? I mean, postmodernists with their denial of a meta-narrative, any overarching story, an explanation for life and history, they'll nod at the teacher, meaningless. Everything's meaningless. Could be taken straight from one of their handbooks. Or listen to Professor Richard Dawkins writing in his book, River Out of Eden. The universe we observe, he says, has precisely the proportions we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. As that unhappy poet A.E. Housman put it, for nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither care nor know. And Dawkins goes on, DNA neither cares nor knows, DNA just is, and we dance to its music. You feel if Dawkins read The Teacher, he wouldn't just say at last someone asking the big questions, but maybe at last someone willing to give the honest answers. A life summarized by a shrug. Well, why spend time listening to this man? Well, he's actually got some credentials. See, look at verse 12. I, the teacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. This is not at first sight the blog of a moody teenager or student, nor what he's got to say to be dismissed as the ramblings of a midlife crisis or the jottings of a grumpy old man. No, look, verse 13. I devoted myself to study and to explore by wisdom all that's done under heaven. In other words, serious research has gone into this book. This isn't just life summarized with some sort of witty one-liner. This is also life studied. It's as if we're reading his PhD thesis. And it's been thorough research. He hasn't confined himself to the library. He's study and to explore, as we'll discover. He's gone and tried it out firsthand, no expenses spared. And it's written to save us having to wander down too many blind alleys ourselves. Here's an honest appraisal of life if you're going to really look closely at it. And he's no fool. You saw right at the beginning of the book, in that opening verse, the words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. He's got Solomon-like wisdom himself. But brains alone can't solve this. See, there are problems that wisdom can see, but not solve. That's the most frustrating thing of them all, isn't it? It's okay to be a fool. You didn't even realize there was a problem. But to know there's a problem and not solve it. Look at verse 15. What is twisted cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. In fact, the teacher, as you go on, you'll discover, sees this as something that's quite deliberate, that God's made this world so that we can't explain it. There's a frustration, a not being able to work it out that is built into it. It's why when Professor Richard Dawkins sets up his great God of Reason, he misses two points. One is that we have a world that can be studied, explored, marveled at, but not ultimately explained by that reason. And the other is that the deviousness of human thinking affects even the reasoning of a mighty brain like his. And if you do realize that, it only adds to the frustration. That's why you see at the end of chapter 1, as he's done all his thinking, he says, "With much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief." Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell were two of the biggest brains of the 20th century. They once wrote a little booklet, and in it is this sentence: "We have found that the men who know the most are the most gloomy." Isn't that interesting? Thousands of years earlier, this teacher had said the same thing. The more knowledge, the more grief. But then, as he puts it, there's nothing new under the sun. Yet here is life studied. And it's not just in the sort of academic world. As you enter chapter 2, which is far more fun read than chapter 1, I'm afraid. You'll have to read it for yourself afterwards. You see, come now, he says, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what's good. In an age when tests and exams seems to have sort of multiplied exponentially, don't they? And when you can get A-levels and degrees in subjects we would never have dreamed about in my day, here's one they missed out. Our school curriculum is still too narrow. Universities still don't offer masters in pleasure. If they did, then our guide, the teacher, would have got one. He's brilliant at it. You see, here's a sort of PhD, a master's we'd all want to take ourselves. Don't worry if you're not academic here, you'll still want to be in on this. You see, look how he goes on in verse 1. I thought in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure to find out what's good. Now, that's a kind of test we'd all like to take. He goes for it, all right. You just read through and you'll see he tries out laughter in verse 2, the sort of fun of a game or a party, pleasure. That's a more upmarket word, a more sort of highbrow one, you know, the opera buff, the theatre goer, the concert devotee. He tries wine in verse 3. He's certainly very happy for that. He's got all kinds of things. The creative side comes out as you go in verses 4 to 9. Landscape gardening on a grand scale. Touch of the retail therapies there in verses 7 and 8. And I acquired men and women singers. He knows the power and attraction of music. He enjoyed it to the full. You know, people say, I live for my music. Well, the teacher knows that. And you see how verse 8 ends, a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man. He's had the wine and the song. He certainly wasn't going to stint on the women either. All the women a man could want to. We're told that Solomon himself had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I have no idea how he coped. Yeah, is this your thing? Well, our teacher has been there, done it, got the T-shirt. In spades. I denied myself, verse 10, nothing my eyes desired. This was thorough research. I refused my heart no pleasure. You see, no moral handcuffs as he went about it. And yet, verse 11, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. Chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. Here's the morning after the night before, isn't it? He knows that feeling. You've known it, you've been on the high, and then you come to the next day and, it's just like that. Nothing gained under the sun. Chasing of the wind. Jack Higgins, the author of The Eagle Has Landed and many other novels, was once asked in an interview, is there anything you wish someone had told you before you set out on all that success? And he said, yes, I wish someone had told me that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. Meaningless. And it's true for work as well. You see, as you read on in chapter 2, he realizes you can live for your work. But where's it going to get you? And who are you going to give the results to? John D. Rockefeller had an income of approximately $1 million a week towards the end of his life, yet his doctors only allowed him to eat a bare minimum. He lived on a diet a pauper would have hated. Someone wrote, now less than than 100 pounds in weight, he sampled everything at breakfast, a drop of coffee, a spoonful of cereal, a forkful of egg, and a bit of a chop the size of a pea. He was the richest man in the world. He couldn't even enjoy his food. See, the teacher knows, and as you read the book, you'll find, the thought of death is never very far away. Better to be wise than to be foolish, but actually, whether you're wise or foolish, you both land up dead. What's the point of it all? Life studied with a sigh and a heavy one. And you see, through it all, what we're all longing for is, for the last one, life solved. This book will face us to the realities and give us the answers. Well, he may do, but let me tell you, the teacher, who is certainly no atheist, and his book's in the Bible for a genuine purpose, but this isn't a book that just brings G-O-D, God, in as a simple answer to all my worries. If we stay under the sun, then it's hard to justify meaning and purpose to life with a God limited to the here and now, to time and space. The teacher is no atheist, but he won't allow glib answers, I'm afraid. And you'll find this book keeps rocking the nice, neat, simple certainties we want to have about life. It'll keep driving us and driving us and driving us to see where, if we're just going to stay in the here and now, the meaningless to which we are actually going to find ourselves forced. Because until I see the dead ends, I'll never look where there's an answer. He won't let me give up on life. But let me give you one little clue this lunchtime. The rest must wait. Watch in these two chapters as you read them over where his wisdom comes from. You see, in chapter 1 and verse 13, I devoted myself. Verse 14, I have seen. Verse 16, I thought to myself, look, I've grown in wisdom, I've experienced. Verse 17, then I applied myself. And now come over to the end of chapter 2 and verse 26. To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. Look under the sun. All you'll be able to do is shrug and sigh, if you're honest. Discover wisdom from outside? Then we can put the smile on your face. You see, and the Bible speaks of the one who came from outside. The Jesus who is our wisdom and our rescue. Who knows the realities and frustrations of life under the sun, but he can not just echo the teacher's questions. Remember how he began, chapter 1, verse 3, what does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? Well, leave Ecclesiastes for today. Come to page 1012, come to Mark's Gospel, and hear that same question put again. Mark chapter 8, verse 36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? See, his striking answer has come just before, in verse 35. Whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. You see, he wants to save us pointlessness and meaninglessness as well as a godless eternity. And yet he says, we'll only do that when we discover there's more to life than life. So what's he teaching us? Expect questions from life. Be free, even as a Christian, to face the bleak realities of life under the sun. There's no need to pretend that they're not there. But he wants me to humble myself so that I can listen to God if I'm ever going to understand. I want to find things out for myself. I was brought up, educated to be self-sufficient. This teacher is going to drive me to despair to make me listen to the only voice with an answer. We'll have to come back next week if we want any more. Thanks for listening.